This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Ron Rash is a poet, novelist, and short story writer whose 2009 novel Serena was a New York Times bestseller, and it was turned into a feature-length film. Ron Rash likes to set his stories in Appalachia. His latest collection of stories illustrate the point. Something Rich and Strange is a collection of 34 of Rash's best stories from the past 20 years. Some are set during the Civil War or the Great Depression, but most take place in the present. Ron Rash is a professor of Appalachian Studies at Western Carolina University, and he joins us now. Ron Rash, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Good to be here.
You have written short stories for some time now. Your idea is, do you like working in short fiction? Do you prefer that to novel writing?
It is my favorite form, and in part because it's the most difficult to do well, I think. To write a successful short story, the writer has to, in a sense, have the concision of poetry, yet the narrative satisfaction of a novel. And that's pretty hard to do, but when someone such as Flannery O'Connor or Chekhov does it, it does something I don't think any other form of literature can.
You do have to be concise, and also your ideas when you think about a narrative form, kind of beginning, middle, end, but there's always a twist in yours. There's always something a little bit different. Where do your ideas come from?
They tend to come more as images, and perhaps that's my poetry background, but I tend to begin with an image, someone en route, usually somewhere. I get curious and wonder where they're going.
Is there an image that stands out in this collection that really kind of stands out for you in terms of how a story came together around that image?
There is. There's a story called 3 a.m. and the Stars Were Out, and it's a story about a veterinarian in his 80s. And I started that story knowing that there was an older man driving a truck late at night, and I knew he was headed somewhere he really didn't want to go, but he felt he had to.
And that's where it started for you. And then you just follow along, huh? Do you get to the end, or do you start filling in the backstory first? What happens?
I tend to go straight toward the end, and then for me, the real writing begins after that. I usually do about 14 to maybe 20 drafts on a short story, and the story begins to come together, and sometimes takes me in turns that I hadn't anticipated.
You kind of get to the end of the story and then ask, how the heck did he get here?
Yeah, and I think that's, you hope the reader feels that same way, yet at the same time, not tricked, but satisfied.
You live and teach in Western North Carolina, and a lot of your stories are set in that kind of a setting, Appalachian setting. Is there something in particular about the area, the way it looks, feels, that you sort of attribute to your creative process?
It certainly is the landscape I'm most interested in, and in part because my family has such a deep background in that region. Both my mother's family and my father's family have been in the Appalachians for actually over 200 years, so it's a landscape that I'm very interested in, but it's also, I think, one thing I hope my writing does is to perhaps not allow easy stereotypes, either of sentimental view of mountain people in the region or demonizing them.
You talked about going through multiple drafts. Is that some of what you screen out of the story? Do you find yourself sort of quickly putting in a stereotype and then having to kind of screen it out over the course of the drafts, or is that not a problem for you at this point?
I don't think it's a problem. I start with the assumption that that ultimately, as Eudora Welty once said, one place understood helps us understand all other places better. And so I'm trying to get to something that I feel is true of all people. And I think if I can do that, if in a sense a reader from another country or another region recognizes something in common with the characters, despite the differences in culture, the way they speak, then that's my goal.
Talking to Ron Rash, his latest collection of short stories, Something Rich and Strange. Wonder if I can get you to read for us from Nighthawks. Can you read something for us?
Sure. Yeah, this is the end of a story, the story Nighthawks, and it's about a woman named Jenny who's had a very troubled life, and there's a part of her that wants to stay away from people, but a part of her that yearns for some kind of connection, and she ends up being a late-night disc jockey. Jenny slept as the sky cleared to a high, bright blue. By noon, the temperature was in the 40s. When her alarm clock went off at 3, she lay in bed a few minutes, listening to cars slosh through melting snow. She would not need a ride into work. She would drive herself across town, looking through safety glass as she passed the school where she had taught, then the hospital where her face had been stitched back together, the restaurant where she and Andrew had eaten breakfast. At the radio station, she would unlock the door, and soon enough Hubert McClure would end his broadcast and leave. She would say, "This is the Nighthawk," and play after midnight. Jenny would speak to people in bedrooms, to clerks drenched in the fluorescent light of convenience stores, to mill workers driving back roads home after graveyard shifts. She would speak to the drunk and sober, the godly and the godless. All the while, high above where she sat, the station's red beacon would pulse like a heart, as if giving bearings to all those in the dark, adrift and alone.
Ron Rash reading from the story Nighthawks, part of the collection Something Rich and Strange, the latest from Ron Rash. As we said, this is a collection that spans 20 years. When did you write that one?
Oh, that one probably was about 17 or 18 years ago, yeah.
You feel like your writing has changed in that time?
I think so. I mean, one hopes as a writer that there's an improvement, that the craft, that you learn things through experience. I do feel like there's a concision to my work that I didn't have earlier on.
How did you select the stories for this volume?
I went back through my five previous collections and with some trepidation because I tend not to reread my work. I've never reread one of my novels, but I went back and looked at my first collection and then my second and third, and I chose the ones I felt held up best.
Well, it seems to work. The New York Times picked it one of the best books of 2014, this collection, so nice job.
Well, thank you.
I don't know if I'm announcing that, but I think it's really fairly fresh news. So congratulations. Your 2009 novel, Serena, was a huge success, and then it became a film, right?
Right.
What was your involvement in the film itself?
I think my big involvement was not to be involved. And I think that made them happy and probably made me happy, too. One funny thing that did happen was that I didn't read the screenplay or anything, but I did talk to the screenwriter several times. And one of the British actors who's in the movie actually called me, and I wasn't sure what he wanted at first, but it turned out he wanted to hear my accent. And I can just imagine this conversation between the screenwriter and the British actor. It's Toby Jones. They really do talk like this. Dial this number.
I can't make that thing happen in the back of my throat that way. Well, now you also you didn't read the screenplay, and you may have been one of the millions of people who didn't see the film. Your book was highly successful, the film not so much. How do you take that? I mean, do you sort of take that personally, or are you not? When the film
No, I go into it with the idea that my hope is primarily that the film, whether it's critically acclaimed or not, that it will bring readers to me, to the book, to the novel that may not have heard of it otherwise, right. May not have come across it.
Well, another one of your books, The World Made Straight, was also made into a movie. It's going to be released next year. That also was shot in North Carolina. What about that? Were you involved much in that?
A little more. Actually, it's very interesting because the director, David Burris, and I grew up or spent a few years where we were in the same town, small town of Boiling Springs, and also our parents knew each other. So there was a kind of interesting coincidence of years later coming and I don't think initially knowing that and then finding it out. So it's been an interesting experience. I haven't read the screenplay. I really have made a choice to kind of stay out of this and you know, it's their project now, but I think they've done a good job. I really get a sense that they paid really real special attention to the accent, to the kind of dog that would be in certain situations. They've been very meticulous.
Well, it's a film. Of course, North Carolina is a filmmaking center, or was until the end of incentives, where we're watching people pack up and move out. But that's kind of an interesting thought. If you think about North Carolina being kind of second only to L.A. in the filmmaking industry up until the loss of incentives, how different that might be, because it's also, North Carolina is also rich territory for writers. And of course, what we hear about Southern writers is it's the rich storytelling tradition that makes them writers. We kind of think it was the incentives that made this place a filmmaking capital. But what is it? Let's talk about that Southern writers thing. I understand you don't like to be called a Southern writer.
Well, I wouldn't say not like. I have ambivalent feelings about it. I mean, I'm certainly Southern. I'm certainly proud of that literary tradition. Going back to Faulkner, going back even to Poe, my only objection to it is that I think sometimes there's a just put in front of it. You know, he's just a Southern writer, and sometimes I find it interesting that someone will say, "Well, such and such is a regional writer," and usually that's someone Southern writer, and regional can imply, in a sense, not transcending that, but I find it interesting that no one considers Richard Price a regional writer, though he writes almost exclusively about New York City, and he writes about it brilliantly.
Well, I wonder if that says more about the richness of the South. In other words, yeah, if you put a just or an only in front of it, or suggest that the only reason you're getting any reading at all is because folks in your region are reading it, that would be obviously dismissive. There's something about Southern writing that is almost an accolade in itself. Oh, he's a Southern writer, as in Faulkner, that sort of thing. So that's right. That's a tradition. I mean, you don't want to be a Midwestern writer necessarily, or known as that, but you might want to be known as a Southern writer.
Right, and I mean, I'm obviously being contradictory here, but I do see myself in that tradition of those writers. Though I would say that what makes Faulkner, O'Connor, Welty, Tennessee Williams, all those writers ultimately great is that while their work is intensely Southern, it also transcends right. The region as well.
Right. And that was the beauty. Well, can I get you to read for us again?
Sure. This is the end of a story actually based on something that happened in my family. And it's...
This is the story Return? You're going to read from Return?
Yeah, this is Return, and it's actually based on my uncle coming back from World War II. He had been fighting in the Pacific Theater and had been actually shot. His helmet had been hit by a Japanese sniper, and he came back in a snowstorm, and I always thought that it must have been so striking for him to have been in the Pacific and in that heat and then suddenly be coming home in the snow. He knows there are mountains in Japan, some so high snow never melts on their peaks. He wonders if the man he killed was from the mountains, a farmer like himself, just as unused to the loud, humid island nights as he'd been. A man used to nights when all you heard was the wind. He wonders if the Japanese soldier's last thoughts were of home. He trudges past Tom Watson's pasture. A little farther, the big beech tree he and Joel had dared each other up as kids. The snow is easing some, and he can see better. The creek runs close to the road here, hardly more than a trickle now. The road curves a last time. On the right-hand side is the barbed wire fence that marks his family's land. He passes above the bottom land where he and his father will plant corn and tobacco in a few months. He imagines the rich black dirt buried deep and silent under the snow, how it's there waiting for the spring's plow and seed to fill it with life. Like the dead, he thinks, waiting to be resurrected. He sees the candle in the front window, but he will wait a few minutes longer before he steps onto the porch. He walks across the yard to the spring. He kneels beside it, unknots the duffel bag and removes the helmet. He fills the helmet and drinks.
Ron Rash reading from Return, one of the stories in his latest collection, Something Rich and Strange. Your stories do recollect stories and recapture some of the history of the region. And also you're looking forward and kind of at the current events and the current culture and landscape in your part of the world. You take on issues of crystal meth and how that's playing a part, and particularly in Western North Carolina.
And I think it's an under-reported travesty. It's really horrible what's happening with this drug, not just in North Carolina, but in rural areas all over the nation. It's a very devastating drug, maybe as bad as any. And I sense that because it's in the rural areas, it's not the focus of a lot of attention, or as much as maybe it should be.
How did you take on those stories? How did you approach writing those stories?
The most important thing is I didn't want to sensationalize it. And so what I've done in the stories in Something Rich and Strange is I haven't dealt directly with the users as much as the people, the parents, the children, in one case, the boyfriend of the people that are using it, to show the devastation that really occurs, not just to the individual, but to, in many ways, a whole community.
Well, Ron, thank you for talking with us. And again, congratulations. Your book is one of New York Times' best of 2014. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ron Rash, professor at Western Carolina University, the author of Something Rich and Strange, a collection of short stories. We say goodbye today to intern Alex Curley. He has been with us for several months, doing a great job producing actual segments here. Terrific work. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he is our tallest intern. I do not think we've ever had a taller intern. He's going to go on to NPR to work in their Berlin programming. Alex, there is no Berlin programming at NPR. I'm sorry. They fooled you. What is this like? This is Deutsche Nipper, I guess. He's going there. Congratulations. Good work up there. Say hi to my pals. Thanks so much for being with us. And thank you for listening to The State of Things. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.